Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to KBOO's Political Perspectives this morning. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlin, your host, and today we're going to be talking about developments in immigration, in the immigration struggle here in the Pacific Northwest. I have two guests for you, not necessarily the ones you saw on our schedule. I'm sorry to say there's been a change, but we've got a great guest for you. So our guests today are Maru Mora Villapando, an activist, a long-term activist in the Seattle area for immigrant rights, who's being targeted by ICE. I'll say a little bit more about her in just a moment. Our second guest, and he will come on in the second half hour, is Tim Schechtel, and he's with Gorge ICE Resistance, an organization that's been demonstrating, rallying, and working to support the struggle of people who are scheduled for deportation are in our state prison in, or county prison, I believe it's operated in the Dalles. So he'll be our second guest. So and there's a bunch of other developments in the struggle around immigration that I'll bring you up to date on before we're over. I'm very excited to be able to bring you Maru Mora Villapando. If you are a regular listener to Democracy Now!, you may recognize that she's been on that two or three times. And if you're just an activist in the immigration world in the Northwest, you may have heard her name in relationship to the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma. She's with the organization, one of the founders of the organization of the Northwest Detention Center Resistance. And she's been a very active and successful organizer in that movement. She's also well-known and respected in the immigrant community and in immigrant rights community throughout. She works with the University of Washington's, I think it's called the Immigration Clinics. And she also works with an organization called Mi Gente, which is a national network of Latinx and women, and I believe it's women, but it highlights the struggles of all immigrants that are going on right now. So she has received a notice from ICE to be deported. She's fighting that, and we're going to hear much more about that and also about the struggle going on right now at the Northwest Detention Center. So welcome, Maru Mora Villapando.
Thank you. Good
morning. Good morning. Did we just lose you there?
No, I'm here.
Oh, I heard a little beep. Sorry, that was probably in my headphone. So happy to be able to reach you. I know that tomorrow you have your case in court and that you're already in legal action. You filed the legal thing yesterday. But can we start a little bit back? Can we go back to, say, 2014 when you were part of forming the Northwest Detention Center Resistance and talk a little bit about the detention center there and why that's become such a focus for your attention?
Yes, the detention center here in Tacoma, Washington is one of the largest ones in the West Coast. It had been ignored for a really long time, although there have been efforts in the past to bring attention to this large detention center that opened in 2004 with, I think, 300 beds, they call it, instead of people. It kept expanding to the capacity that is now 1,575 people. So we felt that it was important to bring to the Pacific Northwest the understanding that we are not as progressive as people want to believe, that we cannot call ourselves a place that is friendly to immigrants and hold one of the biggest detention centers in the West Coast. And that also is it's part of this huge deportation machine that kept increasing, even on their own, and that it serves the purpose of scapegoating immigrants to build a rhetoric against immigrants, especially xenophobic and racial, right, based on color of skin. But most importantly, that also it serves the purpose of big profit.
Maru, we're having a little something with your phone go on. A little beep comes on and we lose a word of yours. I don't know if there's anything you're doing that can change that. I don't know if it's a little too close to your ear and mouth and it bumps something or an earring, but I wanted to let you know about it and we'll go on. We can still hear you, but it is a little bit distracting. So okay, go ahead and talk. If we have to, we'll go offline and we'll call you right back. So I'm getting the picture that you're giving us of the Northwest Detention Center and why it's so important. I know I saw some numbers that say deported from the Pacific Northwest as a whole in 2017, there were 3,400 people, and that there are something like 940 people in Washington County, which is really like a county adjacent to the city of Portland, but a suburb of Portland, and another 824 out of Multnomah County that are pending, that have pending deportation cases. And some of them may still be held in detention, though often when they get their court case, they sometimes are released into their own homes. I don't know. The numbers are hard to find, and they come from a variety of sources. But I have heard, as long as maybe even 10 years ago, about really horrendous conditions in the women's section of the Northwest Detention Center. Things like rats, overrunning toilets, bad food, any number of those kinds of things that have been, and they would be left to just be, you know, the toilet would be left running over for days or that kind of thing. Can you tell us a little bit about those actual conditions inside there that the people were facing there?
Yeah, well, precisely when we decided to do our civil disobedience actions against the detention center in 2014, that led to the organizing inside of people against their living conditions and deportations. That's how we were able to highlight also the horrendous inhuman conditions people face. All of this because it's cutting corners for these corporation that owns the detention center, GEO.
It's the GEO group that owns that detention center, and of course it's profit-making for them. I assume they like to keep the beds full, quote, beds full, keep that many people
there.
That's right.
They have a contract with ICE Seattle that promises that daily they will have a bed quota of a minimum of 800 people. So obviously it makes more sense for ICE Seattle in other entities around the Pacific Northwest to keep that as full as possible. So we have reports of during our time, I believe it was between 2015 and 2016, where there were not enough beds, so people were sleeping on the hallways. People have always complained about the food. People said this should not be called food. This is trash. Obviously, commissary items are really expensive. So that's another business in itself. If you don't like the food, if you don't like the things that are given here to you, you can just go and buy, for example, a shampoo. A small bottle of shampoo is $8.
Oh, my goodness. Many people, families can't travel there for fear of deportation themselves.
Well, people are allowed to visit if they have a governmental ID.
Okay.
Because the detention center is run by a private corporation. The guards employed by this corporation have no federal authority. So they should not be asking about social security numbers or immigration status. But the truth is that they do. They intimidate people. And a lot of people don't have governmental IDs because many states have refused now to give IDs to people that don't have social security numbers or they're marked, right? And mm-hmm. So people don't want to flag themselves around. And so that makes it even more difficult for people to visit. But the other truth is that right now, half of the population in the detention center in Tacoma are not from the area. They actually come from the southern border, and they're being transported here. People that are claiming asylum, you know, they're looking for asylum,
mm-hmm.
they're being sent all the way from the southern border to the other border. So there are people in this area that are claiming that the detention center needs to remain open so people can visit. But the reality is that half of them will not receive visits because they turn themselves in at the border. They don't have relatives in the area. And even the other half, not everybody have relatives in the area anyway. So it's really a small population that are able to get visits, if any.
Is it also true that when they pick up people who they believe are undocumented from Mexico, that they move to deport them almost immediately rather than even hold them in detention centers very long, unless the person asks for representation? But they try to get them to sign voluntary deportation papers and get them out immediately?
Yeah, we know two things. One is that this is a civil system, and you're not provided with a free lawyer like you have the opportunity in the criminal system. You have to pay your own lawyer. Immigration lawyers are very expensive. Are one of the areas that more money charges. We know that not even 10% of the people in the detention center ever get to even get a legal orientation. So with that, obviously, immigration officials are really good at moving people out of the country as fast as they can because they don't have legal representation. There's right. always the push for people to sign what they think is a voluntary deportation. Most people don't know what they're signing. And we've seen cases since last year, and in the past we see them, but not as often as last year and this year, where people are made to sign. Even if they refuse, literally, ICE officials will push their, use their hand and make them, force them to sign something that they don't want to sign or they don't even know what they're signing. So the vast majority of people deported never got to get even a legal orientation, never were represented, never got the chance to actually fight their cases. And in many, many instances, they were made to sign something that you didn't want to sign.
I understand. You know, I think many Americans don't quite realize how brutal the face of ICE is. I believe it's one of the major faces or facets of fascism that's growing in this country because of the brutality and the way that they can come up to people plain clothes, no ID, no insignia on their car, and just grab them and take them away and say it's legal right there. That's a terrifying tactic, and I think a lot of their tactics are intended to terrify as well as just their part of their brutal way of thinking. You, in 2014, that hunger strike got as big as maybe 700 people in it, and you certainly, you yourself have become more of a focus, and so I want to kind of switch over a little bit now from talking specifically about the detention center to talking about the fact that in December, I believe it was, you received a notice to appear. Can you talk about your own situation and your own struggle?
Yeah, well, as you said, we have been able to get a lot of attention to what's going on at the detention center, but also to what ICE is, right? ICE is not only an agency with more money than many other federal agencies to pretty much destroy our community, to divide our families, to rip people apart from their roots here in the United States. Now they're becoming a full political repression machine.
Say that again, because I think that's correct, a full political repression machine. They're not just a deportation machine. They're about political repression.
Yeah, and we noticed this since 2017. This new fascist regime took over. They were really clear that they were coming after everybody. In February of 2017, there were memos from security to ICE, which it interpreted the executive actions of January 2017 on immigration, and pretty much was given legal to ICE to do whatever they want without limits, without oversight, without accountability, nothing. And so we saw those coming really, really fast down into our communities. And we saw in Vermont with migrant justice, people that were organizing justice for farm workers in the milk industry being taken away. Two of the organizers that were in a really strong campaign were detained. Then we saw a young woman, a DACA recipient from Argentina, that her family had been taken away. She, in Virginia, she went and gave a press conference, and after the press conference, ICE came after her. In September of last year, a man that gave an interview here in Washington State about his girlfriend being detained by ICE because she was located by ICE through an ad in the newspapers that she was selling piñatas. And because he talked about the case, they came after him too.
They followed a newspaper ad that she had put in for selling handmade piñatas, and they came and they grabbed her. And then when they saw her her partners in the newspaper being undocumented, they came back and got him, Mr. Gutierrez. He's at the detention center right now, though he does have legal representation. Is that correct?
He actually was released with a very high bond. The community organized, and they paid the bond, so he's now back with his community. But that happened just in 2017. So yes. By the end of 2017, when I get the noise to appear out of the blue, because I haven't had any triggers that could, you know, put me in a deportation proceeding path, to me it was really clear that they're coming after all of us because of our political work, not because we really fit in any way any criteria for them to take us. It's, to me, was just a clear message of this political repression that now they're starting to develop.
Yes, and there are also ones nationally, other people nationally, Ravi Rakur out of New York, others who have been important activists in the Haitian community that they've all of a sudden targeted and began to try to deport. In your particular case, there's been documents that have surfaced that almost prove that they used your activism as a reason to deport you. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So in January, before we came out public, we knew of Ravi Rakur in New York and the co-director of the same organization, Jean Montreville, that had been deported to Haiti. So we knew by then that this was a clear political motivation. I don't work with Mi Gente. I'm a founding member of Mi Gente. I don't work with the University of Washington. One of my lawyers is part of the International Human Rights Clinic, which we have been working with in highlighting at an international level all the inhumane conditions at the detention center in Tacoma. So we all got together and we realized that we needed to make this public. While we were making this public, we were requesting a form that is called the I-213 that ICE needs to submit to the judge saying why they want that person to be brought to the judge to begin a deportation proceeding. And once we were able to get that form, in the form it says that the reason why I came to their attention was because I gave an interview to a local newspaper where I live from June 2017, where I admit that I'm undocumented, that I have a visa, that I overstayed. And then that I'm a public figure, quote-unquote, that I'm engaged in anti-ICE activities and protests.
And which that you are, and we're glad you are.
Yes, and I'm part of Latino advocacy groups. So they even say that she's part of Latino advocacy groups.
Yes.
So that in itself is not only the political side of it, but the racial, right? The
yes.
racial part of it. That I defend my community, that I'm a Latina, and I defend my Latinx community. And that, to us, it shows a clear political repression. No, this is not about legality.
Right. So you and your attorney have filed a request to terminate the case. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's called a motion to terminate. It was filed on Monday. Tomorrow I have a hearing before the immigration judge in the morning. And hopefully we'll hear from the judge good news, agreeing with us that this is political repression. We don't know, obviously, how the judge will rule. If the judge doesn't agree, then we'll have to continue ahead.
Yes. So, and there's a lot of organizing, I know, going around supporting you for that hearing tomorrow morning in Seattle. And people can find some details for that on Facebook at North. It's NWDC Resistance, Northwest Detention Center Resistance, or other pages. They can find it by putting your name in. And find where that activity is taking place and join it if they want. I know from some friends who live in the Seattle area that they've seen people travel from quite far to come to support you and to support the people in the detention center. I also believe that you've had on your side Maria Cantwell, the senator from Washington. She took you back to, she invited you and you agreed to go back to the State of the Union address. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, we have been working with the senator's office last year, especially on cases of Cuban people that were asking for asylum. And every time her office intervened, we saw very great results. People were being released. So we asked her to get involved with our case. And her office offered us the opportunity to go with her to the State of the Union. To us, it was not an easy experience, but it was a great opportunity to bring back again the message of ending the detentions and deportations. And it's a very difficult environment because once you get to Congress, there's police at almost every door, in every floor. It's very well policed. There's a ton of security. You're not allowed to bring in your electronics with you. You're not allowed to bring in your cell phones. And to sit next to a bunch of people that were clapping every time the guy said something. I mean, just to listen to his voice is already
I know many of my friends and I have a very difficult time actually listening to him. It's easier to listen to the parodies of him than it is to actually listen to him. But I'll be honest, I felt that way about Obama, who was later called the deporter in chief. And I felt that way because he could speak so eloquently and it still be a lie.
Yeah. And I think that what makes it more horrendous for me at this time is how he used people of color and their tragedies to pin them against their own community, right?
Yes.
So when he talked about the stories and people were standing up and I could see them, it just felt like a big low move on his side. And it felt really bad for these people and their tragedies, but also to be being used that way,
yes.
You know, parade this sort of horrible violence that these families have faced and to blame their own community for it. That, I think, was the most horrible part of the whole experience.
Yeah, I think I think I have a good feeling for understanding why that would be so hard when you're there. Now, your attorney is with a project in the National Lawyers Guild, or at least one of your attorneys are, and I was glad to hear that just because the National Lawyers Guild has so often been important to activists in the legal end of the struggles. And so you're going to be going tomorrow at 9 a.m. to, where is that courthouse held? Is that an ICE courthouse of its own?
Yeah, so there's a private building where ICE rents many different floors. It's actually the city corner of the federal building in downtown Seattle. It's 1000 Second Avenue in Seattle.
Okay.
And it's going to court is at 8:30, but we're asking people to arrive before 8. We want to do a quick rally before we go upstairs to the hearing. And yeah, one of my lawyers, Elizabeth Simpson, is part of the immigration project of the National Lawyers Guild, which we worked with before in the past. Pamela Shah and others, Julie Chang and others, we have worked with them for many years now. Because that's what we do, right? We know this is not an isolated case. I actually ask people that are right now also in the petition proceedings that are not detained and that have come out publicly saying, I need your support, I need community to come to me don't let me face ICE by myself during my monthly check-in. So some of those compañeras and compañeros are going to be coming with us. And they'll be there, and we'll talk about their cases. And Alejandra Pablos, too, who also was detained last week by ICE during her check-in. She's another activist for reproductive justice in Virginia. So we want to make sure that people know this is not only about me. It's really about millions of people that are facing this monster, and it's time that this monster is dismantled. It should be abolished. ICE should not exist anymore, because if we let it continue, then it's just going to reach out to absolutely everybody, regardless of being a U.S. citizen or not.
Yes. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Now, I know that I went to the website Mi Gente, and there I could find out about other activists who are struggling in the immigration struggle and other activities going on there. So I want to recommend that website to our audience if they want to hear more about what's going on around other activists around the country. It's can you spell that for me? I can't remember how it's spelled. Is it M-J-E-N-T-E? Mijente? Maru?
Yes. MIJENTE.net.
.net. Okay, great. Yeah, I think it's a good resource for other people to find out about the struggles. And it's both in Spanish and English, so you can find which way works for you best. I want to thank you so much for coming on today. I know you only had this half hour to be with us. Mauro I'm sorry, I find it a little difficult. I'd say your name bad. I apologize, but it's Maru Mora Villapando. And your work is important. It's been important for a while. That's why the government's going after you. I wish you all the best in the hearing tomorrow, and we look forward to hearing what happened there. We'll be following your case. I know you have tremendous support in the community, and that has made a difference in other parts of the country. We'll want to make sure it makes a difference for you.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, and I just want to also give a big shout out to my comrades in the Gulch ICE Resistance.
Yes.
We're really close with them, and we're really happy that they're going to talk about the work they do. It's amazing, and we can continue the support of the people in Tacoma being transferred to NorCal for all of them and their amazing organizing skills.
Yes, that's great. Thank you for saying that, too. I know they feel a real loyalty and connection to your activities and the activities of others at the Northwest Detention Center. And so I'll be really happy that we can bring them to our audience as well. And thanks again, Maru Mora. Let me say it right. Maru Mora Villapando. Thank you so much for joining us. All right, and I believe that we have Tim on the line now. Hi, Tim, are you there? I'm not hearing him. We're having a little bit of technical mishaps here, but we will get that fixed, and we will be joined by Tim Schechtel of the Gorge ICE Resistance. And that's the, if you don't know what NorCal is, it's a county-run, I think state-owned detention center in the Dalles. It provides jobs for many, many people. But we have a sanctuary law here in Oregon, and we said that we would not be assisting ICE in detaining people. It seems to me that we're doing exactly that at NorCal. There's been a great, strong, small group of activists there. I don't know how small, but I mean a reasonable size for a small community in eastern Oregon. And that have been really relentless in organizing there in support of the people being held for deportation. Do we have Tim on the line?
Yes, I'm here, Linda. Thanks.
Hi, Tim. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. So, Tim, I want to ask you first off, and we're going to open the phone lines to other people in about 6 or 7 minutes. So I want the audience out there to know you will have an opportunity to call, and I'll give you that number, 503-231-8187, but I won't really be going to the phone lines for another 6 or 7 minutes because I want to hear from Tim first, and then he can also help us answer questions. So, Tim, talk to us about Gorge ICE Resistance, how it formed, what you guys have been doing, all that.
Sure. Well, to start off, a little bit of history. NorCal, Northern Oregon Regional Correction Facility, is one of, I'm guessing, about six rural detention or corrections facility around the state, and it is not state owned. It is owned by four counties: Wasco County, Hood River County, Sherman County, and Gilliam County. They went together about 20 years ago and took out a bond and built this facility, which would serve the incarceration needs for those four counties. And they have paid off the loan about a year ago, September. And we noticed something about March of last year, about 1 year ago. This month, that we were looking at their budget. We knew that they had historically had contracts with immigration, but we didn't really know the extent of it. And after reviewing some historical budgets, we noticed that the budget had just multiplied exponentially from under $200,000 to over $1 million, and with a range.
This was you and some friends who were just trying to like investigate what was happening there at NorCal.
Well, here's what happened. We have a local indivisible chapter, and we all showed up, you know, right after the election in November a year ago, and you know, basically saying, "WTF, you know, what are we going to do here? We have to." So there was an immigration group subcommittee formed at that time, and several of us focused on that issue. And then one of our leaders, Amber Orion and Soleil Kabakov, said, hey, you know, like, we should check out what NORCOR is doing with ICE contracts, because they've had them before. So we attended a meeting, the next available public meeting, and just asked them, what's your relationship with ICE? What has it been, and what is it now? And in the meantime, we'd acquired historical budget documents to show the revenue from ICE and U.S. Marshals. And then we noticed the current budget, 17-18, was in the works to be approved within a few months to go in effect of July last year, 2017. And we noticed it jumped from, like I said, under $200,000 to over $1 million. And we were going like, whoa. So we started paying attention to that, and we started attending meetings, and we just said, wait a minute. And then we heard what was going on by the group led by Maru up in Tacoma, and we started interfacing with them, and lo and behold, we just we coalesced a group, and that spread from the Dalles to Hood River, White Salmon area. We have participating groups, Gorge Ecumenical Ministries, which is a faith-based clergy activist group. They probably don't like to be called activists, but they certainly are. Columbia Gorge Women's Action Network, Hood River Latino Network, just a lot of...
So lots of good grassroots connecting, networking. Which is a wonderful thing in itself. Let me just tell the audience what's going on. I want to make sure that you know out there that you're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland, and this is Political Perspectives, and we're talking about developments in the struggle with immigration. Right now we have on the line with us Tim Schechtel, and he's telling us about the formation of the organization Gorge ICE Resistance, which is located in the Dalles. Actually, it appears like it's a network of people around the Dalles, and who focus some of their their protest energy, their rally energy goes to supporting those who are being deported through NORCOR, who are being detained temporarily at NORCOR. Thank you, Tim, for the description of how you began to form. I know that I first heard about you, I think maybe I was flipping through Facebook and saw something that said something about Gorge ICE Resistance, and so began to hear about you. I have not heard you reported on very much in mainstream media in the Portland metro area. How has media been responding to you guys' activities?
Oh, that's a good question. Actually, about a year ago, May, I came in to KBOO and sat down with Zelos Merchant.
Uh-huh.
And we had coffee, and I said, this is what's going on. And she was very interested, and so we had kind of a connection. I got her some information for her evening news program. She talked about that. We've done interviews with Street Roots in Portland. The Oregonian kind of picked up things now and then when we made the front page in the Dalles, you know, for starting to picket outside. That made some news. We had a large rally outside on May 5th last year, right at the end of the first hunger strike in NORCOR, which was a continuation of one of the hunger strikes in Tacoma. We did get some attention there. There was over 150 people. There was union people there, carpenters unions, Pecun from in the valley, migrant worker
union, yes.
Farm working organization was there. We had AFSC, we had Emerge, we had Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition, a lot of attention. So we did get some coverage, but really, you know, it's not big in the news cycle. You know, nobody's really following it. We did have some success with a Reuters a reporter who lives in the Gorge who picked up and did a story, and it made it back to Boston and some East Coast progressive.
Well, and I know there's been a bunch of controversy and hard looks at NorCorps for how it treats youth, how it treats underage people, and how it holds them in care. Can you tell us about the conditions that that people who are being scheduled for deportation face in NorCorps, and give us a little bit of an idea of how it is to be jailed there, say, compared to the Northwest Detention Center, and how many you have
sure.
there at any given time, if you know.
Well, okay, I'll start with the origin. So our jail has a contract with through the U.S. Marshals with immigration. They do not actually contract with GEO. They contract through Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is a division of Homeland Security. They have had a contract off and on for the last 20 years. The most recent contract, I believe, was originated in 2000. The last signed document I saw is at 2015. They are charged with providing all care for people who come to them from Northwest Detention Center.
And so what kind of conditions do they face? Are the conditions as bleak as they are that we hear up in, you know, I mean, we hear about rats, well, toilets running over, really, really bad food, not just, it doesn't taste good, but actually like really unhealthy seeming food.
Okay, so here's where we source our information. We actually have volunteer lawyers going into NorCorps on a regular basis. They were actually going in once a week, most of the summer and into the fall, and then it was kind of scaled back a little bit. But volunteer clergy have been visiting with detainees since day one, which would have been the 1st of May.
So that's great, and they can give you a picture of what they see.
They give us the stories, basically, and the clergy are there to basically provide some kind of comfort and some kind of anchor that there are people on the outside who care about them. There are people out there standing on the sidewalk just 50 yards from where the walls are, and that helps them out.
I imagine that's really very good for them.
It is, and we actually have a number of people writing to detainees. So they write letters, and the clergy deliver them to someone who asks for one, and then we have some correspondence relationships going too. But I will say across the board, the information that we have from people being detained is that they would rather be in Northwest Detention Center than at NorCorps.
Well, that's an interesting statement. Tim, I'm going to open up the phone lines, and I believe we do have some people online who want to ask some questions, and they might, or have some comments. They might want to ask those of you as well. So can you be ready to answer questions? And I'll go ahead and open those lines. Who's the first caller? Oh, it's Soleil from the Dalles, also from Gorge Ice. I'm really happy to have her call in as well. Hi, Soleil. It's Linda here. And we have your friend Tim on the line as well.
Good morning, Linda and Tim. I just wanted to add a little bit about the youth at the jail, which is to point out and be really clear that in that youth detention facility, they also house immigrant youth. So I know it's a small number of people, but they come from all over the country. And I know at least of a case last year where there was a young child arrested in or apprehended in the state of Massachusetts, who was sent out to NorCorps and was held for quite some time. So,
and this was an immigration case?
That's correct. An undocumented youth all the way from Massachusetts. And at any given time, there may be 2, 3, 4 children there held by ICE. So, you know, all these issues that have arisen recently with youth in detention,
mm-hmm.
I just want to be really clear, this includes immigrant youth. It's not just juveniles that are held, who've run into trouble with the law. It's also immigrants.
Yeah, and both populations are very vulnerable and need to be held in appropriate conditions. Adult prisons are never appropriate, really, for children. So thank you, Soleil, for calling in and making that really clear about who and what is there. I believe we have another caller on the line, so I'm going to go ahead and go to him. Thank you, Soleil.
Thank you.
And hi, Tom, you're on the line.
Yeah, thanks so much. I wanted to congratulate KBOO and especially Tim for the work he's doing. I know it hasn't garnered as much press as we would like, and we haven't seen a policy change yet, but I've really seen the religious leaders in the area take note of this issue, and Tim's creation of a space to take action has really helped them step forward. And I know that some of the judges and the sheriffs I know personally, they're starting to talk about this issue. So I think it'll take an election to get a policy change, but I really want to congratulate KBOO and especially you, Tim, for the work you've been doing.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thank you. And Tim, is there anything that you would like to say about that?
Yes. I think the national sentiment and the rhetoric coming from the current administration has just fueled this debate. I'm going to kind of pose it, what's just kind of like the NRA gun control issue. There's a lot of people who have lots of power who basically are unable to come up with an equitable immigration policy, let alone an equitable and safe control of firearms. So I don't look for the legislative powers to do anything substantial in any time period. So what we're seeing now is an upswell of citizens who see that this is exercising their democratic right to dissent and their democratic right to create the communities they want to see. It's about self-determination. And I have talked with many people in our community, which is fairly conservative. If you look at across the whole demographic of our state, we're Eastern Oregon, we're small towns.
Yeah, I grew up in Eastern Oregon, several small towns,
yeah, so,
Pendleton and
so
others.
You're familiar with that. But on our daily on the street, we've been on the street every day since May 1st last
wow.
year. Every day.
Wow.
Every Sunday.
That's fantastic, and that's inspiring
Christmas
to hear.
Day, everything. So what we're seeing, a lot of people who are coming out are angry at us. They're flipping us off. They're yelling at us. But a very few of those same people get out of their car, walk up. We are a little bit taken aback, but we have ended up with conversations with these people, and it's about the lack of understanding and the lack of perspective, because by the end of the conversation, we have had several people say, you know, I don't really have any problem with these young people who were brought here as children. I don't really have any problem with those people trying to take care of their families. When you actually connect to them and you have a dialogue, you find out how sensitive a lot of people are who we only perceive as being redneck. You know, they have a lot more going on than a lot of us more progressive and activists and more, you know, we take those people for granted and we should not be doing that.
Yeah, I hear you. They're thinking people who just have a different point of view, and you can work with that.
And, you know, they haven't had any exposure to this. They've just been angry, and they're angry because democracy is not working for them, and it's not working for a lot of people. But when you make that connection, the very first thing we say when people are yelling at us, we say, we hear you, thank you for stopping, and then the conversation tends to go better. And so I would encourage a lot of people who are out on the street, activists like us who are angry, is to get that in check, because you're not going anywhere with that. I mean, there's a certain
right
amount
you, yeah you can't just be angry at everybody that you run into. You need to learn to talk with people. I wanted to say, though, you know, you said we're not relying on the government for anything, and I agree with you not to rely on it, but we can pressure and get some concessions. And I did want to bring up that there is a proposal in city council here to put $750,000 into a legal fund and to hire some lawyers. I actually believe there's a facilitating organization already existing to make sure that everyone who's being deported, who's facing deportation out of Multnomah County or Portland, will have someone put, will have attorney at that hearing, will have an attorney and an opportunity to say, no, we don't voluntarily leave, and we're here for, you know, for whatever reasons they are here for. So I think that's very important. That hasn't been granted yet. The amount hasn't been granted yet. It was only proposed last week. But I think that's an important development that could make a difference to all the folks in the detention centers or before they would ever get to a detention center.
Yes, and I know Maru has that similar thing going on. They had a RV stationed within a block of Northwest Detention Center. So when they kick people out, or, you know, they were just, sometimes people do get out. Their cases are adjudicated to a certain extent so they can actually get out of there. But sometimes they have the clothes that they walked in with. They have no money. And there was a Winnebago or something there where they had people giving give some money, a bus ticket, some legal information, some bilingual information. I want to put a shout out to the Immigration Counseling Services. There is a branch in Portland, and there is an office in Hood River. That team of people has volunteered pro bono work to make an initial legal assessment with every detainee that we come in contact with through clergy and lawyer visits. They won't be able to help everyone, but at least they'll help get an assessment of where they're at.
And most people agree that this kind of assistance is probably the number one thing that we could do at this moment, you know, in terms of helping people who are facing deportation, is make sure that they can get legal care. I believe that there's some statistics that came out last year from Oregon, and it was something like from Multnomah County, 80% of those who appeared before an immigration judge without representation were issued an order of deportation. 44% of those who did appear with an attorney actually won their freedom in the long run. So it makes a huge, huge, won their freedom to stay in the United States, won their case with deportation. So it really is a huge life-changing matter to have legal representation there. And it's not something that guaranteed,
absolutely,
even though these are civil cases, so it's not a criminal case. There's no paid for criminal attorney to help you. And it's good for most people to remember these are civil cases. This is not a criminal charge. Probably one of the only kind of civil cases that involves people being locked up while they're waiting for their case to come to court.
Yes, and I think it's really important that people know about the Supreme Court decision, Rodriguez, that happened a week ago.
Indefinite detention?
And that was upheld, or actually was denied. They are able to hold people indefinitely without due process.
That's what the Supreme Court has ruled, and that's very, very scary because that means all of us, guys, we've had indefinite detention, not by any legal basis, in Guantanamo, and now the Supreme Court has said it's legal to hold immigrants. Basically, they said forever. They have no particular right to a hearing.
They have no right to a bail hearing
at
all until someone at their whim grants that, or they have some legal representation, but they are afforded no due process rights as normal citizens, which is, I believe, it goes directly against the Constitution, saying all people within our borders are afforded these rights. So it is really a massive constitutional issue of injustice.
And it seems on the face of it, certainly a misreading of the Constitution, which guarantees habeas corpus to all people, persons. Doesn't matter if you're a citizen. Doesn't matter if you arrived
That's
in
correct.
The country with documentation. So this, I would say, is one of those judicial activism at work. in saying the Constitution says you do not have the right to habeas corpus. And that, for people who don't realize, that's the fundamental basis of all law that we can, you know, throughout Europe and other parts, many other parts of the world, based on the fact that if you are charged with something, bring the body, show me the evidence, prove that I should be charged before you can hold me. And the Supreme Court has just ruled that that does not count when it comes to immigrants. I'm wondering what it will not count for on that slippery slope as we go forward. You know, only the people in Guantanamo have been able to speak about what indefinite detention has done to them, and only few of them have been able to speak. But it is the most destructive. No hope.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that people will, hearing, and we're trying to disseminate these points, these mm-hmm. questions. And this is reality. These people, they are in detention every day. Their children are in detention. Their children are being separated from them. Their children may be American citizens, but their parents are not. This is absolutely undermining the fundamentals of a safe community.
Yeah,
a participatory community.
Let me bring up a couple other legal activity, legal issues that are happening here in Oregon. One is an ACLU lawsuit. I tried to get someone on from the ACLU, was not able to, but they filed a lawsuit in the last month, I believe it is, that is based on stopping ICE from being able to go to civil court house when
agreed.
And pick up people. I'm not saying it very well. ICE will show up at a courthouse where they know that someone, because of their last name even, just looking at the court records, is having a civil case, and then wait outside to grab them when they come out or on their way, when they're on their way out of the courthouses. They named 11 particular specific occasions on which this has happened in the lawsuit. And they're supposed to stay away. It's a matter of safety. If people cannot go to a courthouse without fear of being taken, then that makes us all unsafe. That means we're all not getting to have the kind of legal coverage we should have. So that's one important battle going on that people should just keep their eyes and ears open to.
We have actually participated in a legal observer training, and we are several of us in our group are authorized as ACLU certified legal observers. We have been to Hillsborough. We've been outside the court. We know how it works. We've seen the videos. And I encourage people to, as difficult as it is sometimes to think about this, is to expose yourself to some of the YouTube videos of the unidentified ICE agents in Hillsborough, in the area, accosting people as they come out, waiting two or three blocks away, picking up two or three people in a sweep, picking up the wrong people, kicking them out a few hours later. Unidentified, uncommunicativative.
Absolutely,
it is absolutely.
It reminds me of the brown shirts without brown shirts on them. The Nazi, front troops. The stormtroopers for the Nazis that went out before the Nazis had fully gained power and did these really violent, threatening things and took the law into their own hands. I did want to mention one other thing, and we only have a minute more, so I want to thank you, Tim Schechtel of Gorge Ice Resistance. You do have a Facebook page that's in that name if people want to look you up. There's one other issue going on. It's called IP22. It's part of the initiative. It's a right-wing group identified as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center, is putting it forward here in the state, have sponsored it, and it would make it harder for people to vote because it would demand birth information about people, like your birth certificate, for you to vote. In fact, everyone in Oregon who does vote would have to re-register proving that they were citizens. This is something that's outrageous. It's not something that we should allow, and it's meant only to harm immigrants and actually to take off the voter list people who might vote in opposition to the current type of regime. I do have to get off right now. Thank you, Tim, for joining us. And
I'm glad to do it. Thank you.
You're welcome. And thank you to all the listeners out there who care about these issues so much. We appreciate you here at KBOO, as you well know. I believe we're about to sign off now. I want to thank Tammy, our engineer, and Derek Crook, our AM News and Public Affairs Director, for their support in us, the volunteers who get this kind of information out to you. Thanks again.